Good morning, friends. I'm not going to say very much, just a few things that I think are important about bringing this practice, bringing what we've realized over the course of this week in our practice, and continuing to practice in our daily lives. And of course, it's really important to establish a daily practice, and what that is for you, I think, is for you to discern and for you to explore. But it's a gift that we give to ourselves out of love. So it's helpful not to think of it as something on your to-do list, but rather a way that you care for yourself because you love yourself. That's certainly when I began to make that shift, it really drew me to the cushion or, the chair. I've left the cushion behind. It's helpful to have a place in your home where you are which is evocative, which gives your heart joy. You know, it has an image or a candle or something that you connect with. It opens the heart. It's a kind of a pointer toward sacred time, sacred space.
It's great to have a place like that, helpful. Sometimes people don't have a space to make a separate room. It could be a corner of a room. And you don't always have to use that. You could sit on in the garden or in a park. Sometimes, you know, if that feels more supportive to you at a particular time, sometimes being in nature is so helpful. And doing walking meditation. I remember I said that I would give instructions for a walking meditation. That's helpful to bring into daily life. And so it's a way that we kind of move our attention into different senses, and the fact that we're focusing in different ways helps the attention to stay connected. Because in walking, the mind tends to drift. We tend to think about what we're doing, where we're going, what we need to do, and so on. So this is beginning by, and you could rotate this in whatever way you like. It could be, for about 20 or 30 seconds, or it could be a number of steps, or a length, like a block. So just rotating through, first of all, feeling the feet on the ground, feet on the earth, kissing the earth. Even if the earth is covered by sidewalk, she's still there, and kissing the earth with each step. Just really feeling that connection to the earth. And then the second one is to feel the whole body moving. So just a whole body experience of the body moving through space.
And then sound, just opening to hearing sounds. And letting sound be simply sound, you know, that the mind will, perception will arise and will label a car or a horn or a baby crying. But just there's a way in which we can not, like when we perceive, the mind tends to just skirt off the sensory experience. So if you hear a car, you know, there's just that the mind doesn't penetrate into the experience of the vibration of that sound. So letting the mind really hear, letting the hearing consciousness hear, and then, you know, noticing how the sound comes and goes, and then seeing. So again, even more so with our sight, we label perceptions. Exploring being not so kind of superficial in the way that we see, but to really allow seeing to happen. Seeing color, light and dark, form, movement, and so on. So walking on the ground, the whole body moving, hearing, seeing, and cycling through that. It's, you know, and for 10 minutes or whatever, you could make that a practice that you do in daily life. I think for me, the most important practice that I do every day is the practice of remembering love, and bringing that love to this being, this heart, this tender heart, and I'm reminded to do it when the voice in the mind, the doubting voice or the dismissive voice or the corrective voice comes in, and so that reminds me, hearing that voice in my head, which is diminishing me, that internalized voice. And then I just turn to the heart with love. And I think this has been for me the most powerful practice as my practice has developed, to really remember to love this tender heart. So it's actually the tender heart loving itself, or just loving, allowing that love to be felt and known in the whole being. And and if you want to do this practice, you know, sometimes even just saying the words, I love myself, I love my whole being. That was an instruction that a friend of mine got from a Sri Lankan monk who was his teacher. So there, it comes from something, someone authoritative, not just Daryl. And so just to turn to the heart with love, and remind ourselves that we're worthy of love, we're good, our hearts are good. And that love, I find, has helped me a lot to be loving. And so it's so much so much a part of how we are made, that when we judge ourselves, we judge others. When we love ourselves, we love others. When we're compassionate to ourselves, we're compassionate to others. So I'd like to just open up for Any questions that you may have, or comments, or sharing about? There will be a sharing in terms of in our closing time at just before lunch to talk about anything that you'd want to share about your experience this week. And I'll give specific instructions for that at the time. But now it's more like, is something coming up? Are you thinking about a situation or anything at all about ongoing practice? So please feel free to just raise your hand or just start speaking.
Well, the thought came to mind when you were talking about a daily sitting practice. I had heard a teacher say, the more you accept yourself, the more you love yourself, the more you want to be here in the retreat or sitting with yourself.
Yeah, that is so true. As a gift, I really do feel that because I love myself, I want to give myself this opportunity to be present with myself. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about I like to call it the asshole in the head, the chattering. Does that, you've been practicing for probably a really long time, do you just ignore it, or is it always still sort of at the same level?
No, yeah, it does diminish. We can change our minds. We can, where the attention goes, the energy flows, and so I think that this loving ourselves, the turning. Offering metta is really a remedy. It's an antidote for that kind of self-judgment, self-criticism.
And it's just the constant blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. Like, I can't say it's been judgmental lately, but it just doesn't stop. Obviously, on a retreat, you notice it way more.
Yeah.
It's just commenting on everything, catching my attention, and pulling me out of this moment over and over and over, and it knows what I find interesting, I guess.
Yeah. Well, bringing the attention back to the senses is helpful, and also just not getting caught up in engaging the narrative, engaging the, in that way, I mentioned in the group yesterday at 11:30 that I don't usually teach labeling because it does draw us away from our direct experience, but sometimes when there's a kind of a drivenness in the thinking, like to notice that this is aversion or this is grasping, but not to use it as a kind of a tennis racket to bat it away, but to just open to what's happening in the body. Coming back to the body is just really it's the practice for so in so many ways. It's the foundational practice to be in the body, because the body is quiet. And so, just even making a practice of of keeping your attention, you know, in the belly, you know, in the hara or in the heart, just bringing your attention lower into the body, I think is really helpful. I found it helpful. I wouldn't say the mind is silent, but the mind is certainly a lot quieter than it used to be. And I'm just not as hooked, I think. And I think that's true, that as practice goes on, we're just, the thoughts are there, but it's not as compelling. Because I think that when we really, you know, after years of watching the thoughts and recognizing how banal most of them are, you know, it's like, oh, boring. You know? It's like, really? I remember being on retreat. Somebody mentioned this recently in one of the groups. I remember being on one of my early retreats, and mine was planning and planning and planning and planning and planning. And it was very similar to what this person said, you know, and I said, okay, I've planned it. I've planned it. It's fine. And it still would go on planning. And it's the drivenness underneath that, you know, the anxiety or fear, lack of confidence, all of these things. Yeah.
My mind was playing TV shows. Mm-hmm. It was catching me with some of my favorite TV shows and showing me all the flaws in the plot lines. And that was so interesting. But it wasn't being mindful.
It was, yeah, it was getting caught up in being the TV critic.
Can you talk a little bit about like investigation versus getting caught up?
Yeah. So investigation is, you know, I talked very, very briefly about the RAIN practice. Probably many of you have heard of it. It's an acronym that Michelle McDonald created or thought of to remind us that we recognize something. So we recognize something coming up in the mind and we accept it. So the acceptance is allowing it to come in, the welcoming it, as in the guest house poem, you know, like not slamming the door on it. And then the I is investigation and the N is non-identify. And it's really, investigation happens because we have some space around it. So the, in a way, the non-identifying is precedes the investigation. We recognize that this is a thought, this is a pattern, a habit of the mind, and we bring that acceptance, that quality of care and non-judgment to the experience and get curious about how we are holding it in the body. So I know that there are also mental parts of the investigation, but first of all, for me in my practice, it's really noticing, you know, where is the body holding it? Is the heart contracted? Is the throat tight? Are the teeth clenched? Are the shoulders raised? And then as we bring mindfulness and acceptance, so care, acceptance is an expression of care, to the experience, we stop holding it. So the experience stays with us because, in a way, we're holding on to it with the body and with the mind. There's a kind of an inner grasping. And so relaxing around it, giving space to it, we can allow it to move, because everything is of the nature to change. And it does change. And so that's part of the investigation, is noticing also how it's impermanent. And that it also is liberating when we see that it actually moves through, begins to change, move through, maybe not immediately. Sometimes it depends on how deeply we're holding it, how deeply embedded this pattern is. It might not move through immediately. It might take some time. But one thing that's really important is, as it does move through, to notice the space in which we were aware of this afflictive emotion or unskillful thought or whatever it was. And it's like I was speaking about earlier in right effort, to when we notice that part of noticing the good, noticing the wholesome, is to notice that the space that is left behind, that it remains, not left behind, but that remains when something that is creating suffering moves through, that is a wholesome and beautiful quality, just that openness, that quality of receptivity and awareness. So the Buddha said, when you notice that, when there's a pattern that you're working with, a habit that you're working with, that you're noticing it's coming up, and you're, you know, as it comes up, you are releasing it. You know, maybe it's grasping around food or aversion, you know, in a relationship. Notice not only when it's there, in order to release it, but also notice when it's not there. So that kind of speaks to the earlier question about noticing when, you know, like, how does the mind stop chattering, you know? And so notice also when the mind is more quiet, and take joy in that, you know, experience, allow yourself to experience the pleasantness of having a mind that is open and receptive and, you know, quiet for a few moments. So that's also all part of the investigation, seeing the impermanent nature of it, seeing how it arises from conditions. Sometimes, when we are investigating something that's arising, we might notice that there were conditions that, in a way, triggered that reactivity or gave rise to it. And so we can notice also part of the investigation, and this could be in daily life or in a sitting, noticing what triggered it. And so we learn from that. So it's getting to know, you know, this mind, which is a changing mind. It's mind, heart, body, all one psychophysical organism. But it's really getting to know how we are not as a noun, but as a verb, how we are, how we change, how we evolve, because, you know, we're not the same person from day to day. Yeah, and the non-identifying is, I've already addressed it, but it's really recognizing that this is a process, that I'm not, there is some ability to respond, but I'm not really in control of this body or this mind. It's a happening, like everything else is a happening. It's just happening, and really the locus of control, the locus of autonomy is coming to the present moment and being aware of what is happening right now. That's the key thing, is having that awareness in the moment. And that enables us to discern what is skillful and what is unskillful in the response. It's so key. No, thank you. Anyone else have anything coming up as a question or something that...
Something's been niggling a bit in response to the locus of control. How does that relate to fatalism? In the sense that if there is no control over what is arising, then this...
No, Buddhism is definitely not fatalistic.
There's a bit of a paradox.
So there are causes and conditions, and they do unfold, and we can reorient our lives in more skillful ways. That's why. I mean, not to say that the Dharma, the Buddhist Dharma, is the only spiritual path that is liberating. I don't believe that. In the Buddhist teaching, you know, that hearing the Dharma is considered a blessing and opportunity. It's one of the elements of precious human life, of blessings and opportunities, and so the Dharma is like something that it's a kind of a medicine that deconstructs, helps us to deconstruct a lot of those patterns and habits that drive us on in samsara, you know, in this trajectory of continued suffering, to deconstruct that, and we reconstruct our lives in ways that are skillful. That's the bhavana, that's the development of the mind, and we, you know, and all of this is through awareness and application of the teachings. So it's not at all a fatalistic teaching.
That's very helpful to entangle that paradox that seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have control in a larger sense of the world around us. And I just want to add, you know, something I thought of this morning when I was just reflecting on joy and you know what I shared about joy and so on, is that I think that this cultivating of joy is really important for me, maybe for us, in to take in what is joyful, to take in what is beautiful, to take joy in, you know, children playing, to take joy in the love that we see of a, you know, a grandparent with their child or somebody working in their garden. Just the simple joys around us, because we can, you know, with all of the news media and the flooding that we get of doom and gloom, and not to say there's not a lot of suffering and a lot of concerns and dangers and threats. I was listening to an interview. I mean, this is not just something that she has said, but she's an activist, Adrienne Mary Brown. And she's written about the importance of joy, and that joy is, in a way, an important element, an important experience to bring into our lives and to share in our lives, because it is the whole capitalist consumer culture is, it's really quite joyless, you know, because we're never good enough, you know, until we've bought the next, you know, model car, or, you know, bought the right shampoo or whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a question about generosity. As you spoke of, and as Buddhism and some other religions also, I think, describe it, it's more generosity, but in terms of love, reaching out when needed, and sensitivity to people and this kind of thing. However, as you were just saying, we live in a capitalist society, and generosity can also be linked to money. How expensive is the gift you buy, or how elaborate is the hospitality you provide? So did the Buddha ever speak? I always wondered, did he ever speak about people with less money and more money? I know he had disciples of all kinds, but does he ever talk about things like that? But some other religions do talk a bit more about social justice, if you will.
Well, I, you know, he modeled a life of simplicity, he was supported by the generosity of some of his donors, and not all of them were major donors. They were, you know, he and the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis would go on their alms rounds and just take what was offered. So that, and that was an important teaching, to not kind of have preferences, but just to take what was offered. He did involve himself in communities, trying to bring peace to different tribes that were at war with each other. It was a different time, I think, and many, many people had very little, I would think. Even in that story of Gautami and the mustard seed, you know, you just see, you know, well, people have lived in the same house for generations. They're not moving around, you know, buying a bigger house all the time, I think the model of simplicity and noticing what do I need. You know, we are householders, and there's a metaphor that's used with, I think it was with the Brahma Viharas, which is that a trained meditator can, just as a king or a prince would choose from a wardrobe of garments what they want to put on, an accomplished meditator can enter into a state of metta, compassion, you know, and so on. And, you know, for me, so that's an interesting teaching that we can, as we become more deeply accomplished and the mind becomes clearer and these qualities become more developed within us, we can, by choice, just move into these states of heart. But I also thought, well, it's interesting that only kings and princes can go to a closet and choose a garment. Like, everybody else has maybe one or two garments that they wear. And that was the norm. And that, so to be able to choose from garments was extraordinary. And all of us have a closet full of clothes that we choose what we want to wear, probably. And, you know, in terms of our own lives, you know, to notice what's driving us, as if we have some guests for dinner, are we trying to impress them with, you know, how lavish the dinner is? Or, you know, would it serve a more intimate and enjoyable gathering to just perhaps serve something simple and have more energy just to be with people that you invited? So,
this is kind of another topic, but like if you're going to set out and kind of create your life, you're driven by your desires, what you want, or I am, and a lot of people are. And well, how wholesome is that? Like, so you have a picture of what you want. Well, how do you go about it? Like, what's your compass
north? Yeah, well, that's a beautiful question. The name of True North is you know, finding that inner compass, right?
Yeah.
That we be guided by you know, what is wholesome. So I think that's something that we. As we mature in our practice and our practice deepens, you know, we begin to ask ourselves what is driving us. So somebody can be driven by, you know, like a lot of greed to get bigger and more and better than everybody else, or can be, you know, more oriented toward offering something helpful, or, you know, looking for a relationship. It could be to continue to evolve as a human being, to have support and give support. These are wholesome things. And the Buddha did teach to householders, and he didn't say that to have some wealth is in itself bad. You know, he didn't say that everybody should become monks or nuns. You know, like, to live, you know, he really encouraged people living as householders to practice virtue and generosity, and to be aware of, you know, like right speech, right action, right livelihood, you know, following the precepts, and you know, and we do our practice, you know. So it's, but I think it's an important inquiry to ask, you know, if we're orienting ourselves towards something, or if there's something we want or we don't want, to investigate, to bring that investigation into what is the energy that's underneath this, you know. Is that?
It still feels like a desire to have something and want to bring it into my life.
Yeah. And so, yeah, desire, you know, like, so sense desire is a particular desire. So sense desire is to be grasping pleasant experiences, sensory experiences. So we do, I mean, you know, the mind does. The mind wants to see pleasant things, the taste pleasant tastes, and how, you know, and so in a way, as non-monastics, we work with a certain amount of desire. You know, if we're in a relationship, there's sexual desire, and that can be a wholesome thing to deepen a sense of intimacy between people. You know, it's the wanting and wanting. Is it a habit? Is it a compulsion? And then wanting, having goals in our lives. You know, it's something we may want, but it may not be desire. It might be, you know, wanting to develop ourselves in a certain way, or wanting to contribute something to society, wanting to involve ourselves in some wholesome, you know, or beneficial activity that, or even an activity that's necessary, you know, like, you know, being somebody who sells things, you know. So that in itself is not good or bad if one is ethical, and if it's not something which is, you know, harmful to the body. There were certain livelihoods the Buddha said, you know, are not wholesome, like selling weapons. So yeah, but I think as people living in the world, we have desires, aspirations, goals, and also these things don't always work out the way we want them, and so we want them to, and so then that's also a sphere for practice, that, you know, equanimity and acceptance to the things, you know, are as they are. Matt Flickstein had this this statement that he would often make to people. He would say, you know, because, you know, people would start practice and they would want to know, you know, well, you know, should I change my whole life? Should I? And he would say, I know the perfect life, the perfect way of life for you to practice. And what? Tell me. The one you have. And it makes so much sense to me, because the lives we have are the lives we've built. maybe we haven't chosen everything, but they are the result of the causes and conditions that we have been part of, the choices we've made, or things that have happened to us that we may not have chosen. And it's the life that we have to practice in right now. Now, and if we're going to change from how we're living, then that will happen through choices, but those choices will happen through awareness of an orientation that we want to make in our lives. And so the lives we have are really perfect for our practice. We have everything we need to practice.
Just add something, if I may. A book that really brought that home for me in terms of, and nothing to do with meditation, was Man's Search for Meaning, beginning to understand that I needed a purpose, not just a goal or a desire, but a purpose.
Yes.
And that's what made my life more meaningful too.
Yes, that is so important. The Dalai Lama said that to I've been taking this program on end-of-life care, mindfulness-informed end-of-life care, and the teacher was talking about I forget the framework. But it was a framework for what we need to be well and at peace in our lives, and she had designed this, she was in some kind of conversation with the Dalai Lama, and he said, "You left out the purpose. We all need purpose." And that is very important. How we understand that purpose, it could be awakening. It could be awakening for the benefit of others. It could be serving those who are suffering. It could be learning about something that, you know, we really value. But this sense of meaning and purpose is a human need. So thank you for adding that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.